This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB, online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the award-winning This Is Money to talk through some of the stories on their website that they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, well, what a last 7 days it has been. What a week for global stock markets. Are we on the brink of a new crisis?
The market seems to have disconnected from the economic reality in some ways. If you look at the US economy, it did grow 2.4% last year.
So markets in turmoil, the FTSE at a 3.5-year low, mining firms hit and billions wiped off the value of the biggest banks. But while some take a step back, others see the turbulence as an opportunity, and Simon's been talking to just them, in between doling out pensions advice to his baby sister. What are those pearls of wisdom? We'll find out a little bit later on. Meanwhile, has market turmoil wrecked your pension drawdown plan? The team will let us know how to rescue your fund from devastating early losses. Also today, bringing up the rear, the final two of the big six energy firms join the party and cut gas prices by a pretty similar figure to all the others.
One of them sets the lead and then the other ones follow. There are smaller players, and that's where the better value is an offer, and that's where we should be looking if we want to get the best deals.
We take a look at the latest smishing menace doing the rounds and ask, are mortgage lenders ageist?
We've got an ageing population and people now wanting to or needing to access housing wealth in ways that they haven't really needed to before.
And Valentine's Day almost upon us. What the price of love? 1 month's wage, 3 months' wage, how much you can afford doesn't really matter at all. I'm talking about engagement rings and how much should you spend?
Roughly, £5,000.
You shouldn't bankrupt yourself about it.
£400.
I am too old for that.
So if you're thinking of popping the big question this weekend, firstly, congratulations. Secondly, don't panic. The team have discovered that the average spend on an engagement ring might be a lot less than you may think. We will reveal all later. But we've been asking today, how much is reasonable to spend on an engagement ring? How much should you spend on an engagement ring? And by all means, if you want to, tell us how much you did spend. A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Rachel. Simon, starting with you, please, how much should one spend on an engagement ring?
Hello, Georgie. I think one should spend as much as one wants to on an engagement ring. So I can't remember exactly how much my wife's engagement ring cost. I can't remember the exact number, but I do know there's all kinds of numbers bandied around, and the jewellery industry is very keen to bandy around things like a month's salary, 2 months' salary, things like that. Most people don't spend that much. But what I would say to people is get yourself down to Hatton Garden. Basically,
yes,
you will save an absolute fortune compared to a high street jeweller's, and you will get a better ring and you will also get a better diamond. So go for a good diamond. It's the, what is it, the three C's? Clarity, cut and something else? Can't remember. Anyway, and you come out with a certificated diamond and that's what you want.
We'll have more tips later and I'll agree with you with that on the Hatton Garden one. Rachel, can I come to you? How much should one spend on an engagement ring?
I have no idea. I thought, yeah, there was some kind of rule like 1 year's... 1 year's.
One year?
Yeah. I thought, yeah, there was a rule, but I don't know whether it's pre or post-tax income.
Fair question to ask as a personal finance editor, of course.
But also, I imagine this story is prompted by Valentine's Day, but we've got February 29th coming up, which is the day that women are allowed to propose. So then I don't know what the equivalent is there.
I haven't really thought too much about it, but now you put that question into my head, I don't know. I thought it was 1 month, 3 months, whatever you can afford. Does it really matter?
Yeah, so what I would say is basically the point of when you get engaged, you're basically setting yourself up for any number of other costs, including saving money for a wedding. So don't spend so much money that you can't afford it on an engagement ring. And it is a really special thing for someone. You know, people treasure it for the rest of their lives. So you know, it is something that is worth, it's hopefully a one-off occasion, it is worth spending the money on. But, like, don't go completely mental.
Share Radio has great news.
We're going national in March 2016, so you'll be able to hear your favourite programmes on digital across the UK. And to listen on the move, just download one of our latest apps. Our new iPad app includes a fantastic and very fast Listen Again feature. And with our newly upgraded mobile phone app, you can listen live wherever you are. Share Radio is going national on the new D2 digital network in March 2016.
It is indeed all very excited about that. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio. In the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the award-winning This Is Money. And coming up, sibling support when it comes to your pension. Finally, a full house when it comes to the big six energy firms dropping prices and the smishing menace we need to keep an eye out for. But first, are we on the brink of a new financial crisis? Global markets are in turmoil. Well, over $1 trillion has been wiped off the value of equities since the start of the week, with household name banks bearing the brunt of widespread concern that another recession could be on the cards. The FTSE 100 fell to its lowest closing level in over 3 years. Now, it's after the chair of the US Fed, Janet Yellen, acknowledged risks to the outlook, and Sweden's central bank cut its interest rate further into negative territory. Here's chief market analyst at CMC Markets, Michael Hewson.
I think it's fairly clear that the Federal Reserve is concerned that the current market volatility could blow the US economy off course, even though she did go to great lengths to remain fairly upbeat on the economy. But there were a couple of lines in there which I took particular note of. One was financial conditions in the United States have become less supportive of growth. Well, if that's the case, then I think it's unlikely that we're going to get a rate rise in March. And she went on to assert that if the economy were to disappoint, a lower path of the federal funds rate would be appropriate. I think that's significant. I think it suggests that maybe there is a little bit of concern there amongst policymakers that this volatility could actually see growth start to tail off, given the problems that we're seeing here in Europe and particularly within the European banking sector.
So billions wiped off the value of our biggest banks, billions more off the value of the FTSE 100. All this a major blow for investors and those with private pensions and ISAs. More woes, of course, for savers, as we're now hearing interest rates may not rise until 2020. But not everyone is so gloomy.
The market seems to have disconnected from the economic reality in some ways. If you look at the US economy, it did grow 2.4% last year. The jobless rate is under 5%. The job market is very, very robust. So in some ways, there's been an overreaction.
It's difficult out there. We know it's difficult. We can see the volatility in stock markets and the uncertainty from a variety of angles. But just maybe, the reality is it's not quite as bad as people think. Apocalypse can be postponed, and there are ways and means around some of these challenges.
Apocalypse can be postponed. Rebecca Byrne from the Wall Street Journal first, finishing up there with Financial Orbit's Chris Bailey. So, rather mixed messages. Simon, I'm going to come to you. Let's talk about the banks. Deutsche Bank's chief exec and the German finance minister coming out this week to publicly claim that the bank is rock solid following a dramatic drop in their share price. But they are not alone. Since the start of the year, Credit Suisse has lost 40% of its value, UBS down almost 30%, and French giant Societe Generale 31%, figures that would make any investor panic, I imagine. Wall Street not immune either. Is this a banking crisis, a banking failure? Now, we've seen The Big Short. We're now talking again about credit default swaps and what are cocoa bonds. Explain, what's going on?
Where do I start? I don't think that we are in a fully fledged banking crisis, first of all, to answer that question. I think maybe we can have Apocalypse Postponed. Was that the sequel to Apocalypse Now, maybe? I think that what's going on at the moment is a big sort of freaking out in the markets. And I would say that this is related to two main things. One, negative interest rates, and the market has decided that it does not like the prospect of negative interest rates and that negative interest rates are going to be bad for banks. And also, something that came in at the start of the year in Europe, but is already in place in the UK, which is something called bank bail-in, meant to be the plan for dealing with any form of bank failure. That means that we don't have to do what we had to do last time round, which was, of course, bank bail-out. If a bank makes big losses or a bank fails and it's what's known as its core tier one capital falls below the level that it should be, then a call can be made on the bank, people who've lent the bank money, yeah. And that can then be converted into equity, which is considered to be a lower grade level of investment. And investors have decided they don't like this. So basically there's these things called cocoa bonds, came out of the back of the last financial crisis, and they are effectively something called subordinated debt. Basically they're bonds that can be converted into equity, or potentially they're bonds that could have their coupon payments, their interest payments suspended. And the financial authorities under the new bail-in laws could impose this on a bank if it made big losses and its capital fell below a level that it should be at. And investors have suddenly turned around and looked at these cocoa bonds and gone, whoa, hang on a minute, we don't like the sound of this. We've been snapping these up in droves, and actually we don't like them, and we're going to start ditching them. And they've started ditching them. The price of them has dropped dramatically. If you look at Deutsche Bank's cocos, they've absolutely plummeted. At the same time as you've also got this big concern over negative interest rates, making it harder for banks to make money, because negative interest rates mean that basically banks who place money on deposit with central banks get charged for the privilege. And the theory behind negative interest rates is that the banks would then basically pass that cost on to their customers. Their customers would decide not to leave money at the bank and would instead invest it or spend it, thus boosting the economy. But so far, actually, in reality, most of the banks haven't passed this cost on to their customers, and they've just absorbed it themselves. Largely, I think, because they've decided that if they do try and pass it on to customers, and when I say customers, I don't just mean you or I. Mm. I mean you or I and businesses and financial institutions, you know, the people who are responsible for large amounts of money, because they're worried that if they do it to their customers, the customers will basically just go to the next bank who isn't doing it. So they've been absorbing it so far. And investors have looked at this whole scenario and decided that they don't like negative interest rates. They're a little bit worried about this concept of bank bail-in, and they definitely don't like these cocoa bonds at the moment. And the common thread running through three of the big name banks who have been affected in Europe, Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse and UniCredit in Italy, is that they are all in the middle of massive restructuring programs and have made big losses.
Will any fail?
Well, they don't have to fail. You see, this is the thing, is we think of bank failure as in complete bank collapse, but banks are required to have a certain thing called Tier 1 capital ratio, which is the ratio of a bank's core equity capital to its total risk-weighted assets. It needs to hold a certain amount of money, or what is considered to be capital money, basically compared to its balance sheet. And if it makes big losses, then that sinks. And so it needs to get some more of this, you know, core Tier 1 capital from somewhere else. And that's where the risk comes in, that basically these cocoa bonds will get tapped into, and either that some of them will have to be converted to shares, which are considered to be an inferior investment, or that they'll have to suspend the interest payments. And there's a great line about these cocoa bonds that said they basically appear to offer all of the upside of bonds with all of the downside of equities, which basically is saying that you ain't going to make a lot of money on them, but you are taking a lot of risk.
A lot of this also paints a picture of what's happened since 2008. So regulation, you're talking there, the role that central banks have had to play in all of this. Has trust, do you think, been a bit lost in central banks? We're hearing a lot of comparisons with the Great Depression of the 20s, the 30s in the US, and the errors that were made there by central banks. Indeed, financial commentator Alistair Heath saying that they've just been kicking the can down the road since 2008. Rachel, what's your views?
This is, I think, precisely the problem. So much of what's going on here is fear. And Simon and I were talking about it earlier. Honestly, do you think if someone said now, everything's fine, and that voice was someone who economies trusted, things would pick up a bit? But there's such fear, and there isn't that voice any longer. Since we've had so many central bankers who called it last time, who said it was fine, and it totally wasn't, why on earth would you ever trust a central banker? And indeed, when you hear a central banker saying that everything's fine, then there's even more of a freak out, because why are they having to say that? It's the same as the banks.
But isn't the role of the central bank, though, just to make the economy tick along? They're not supposed to interfere. Shouldn't we have them pulling back a little bit, Simon?
Maybe, but, you know, one of the things that has fallen to central banks is basically the responsibility of sorting out what happens in the financial system and how it's regulated and how it's controlled. And I've got the Bank of England paper on bank bail-in here, and I'll just read you a bit that says, during the recent financial crisis, it was necessary for the authorities to intervene to limit the disruption from failing banks and other financial firms. This included providing public funds to recapitalise some banks. Although this successfully stabilised the financial system, the cost of doing so was borne by the public. so by the taxpayer, basically. As part of the package of measures adopted in the aftermath of the crisis, a new tool known as bail-in was introduced to help ensure that shareholders and creditors bear the costs of firm failure. So what this is saying is that we're not going to pick up the tab next time. The world has put in place a framework, you know, in the UK, in Europe, in the US, that says basically if one of these big banks fails next time round, we, the taxpayer, the state, are not picking up the tab in the way that we did before. We've created this framework for how it's going to happen, and how it's going to happen is going to hit investors harder. And another thing that I should have mentioned about bail-in is that basically the other people who are on the hook are what are known as unsecured creditors. And these are basically people who have more than the compensation limit in the bank. So if you've got more than 100,000 euros in Europe or 75,000 pounds in the UK, then that money in your savings account above that level is potentially up for grabs if the bank, you know, starts to look like it's failing, you know, makes big losses or collapses. So that is a very good reason why people should pay a lot of attention to that £75,000 financial services compensation scheme limit.
And it's so easy to do as well. It's not that if you've got more than that amount of money, well, then it's at risk. You just sort of shift it around and make sure that you have it in a different number of banks so that you don't go over the cap at any one.
So, by and large, are you on the side of being rather negative about this or positive, Rachel?
I believe so much of it is sentiment, so I want to say it's all fine, because I think if we all did, it probably would be. We've seen these incredible days over the past couple of weeks where the markets just fluctuate by 2%, and we all scramble around at This Is Money to work out what's happened. Surely there's been some kind of announcement, there's been some more negative data coming out of China or something like that, but China's been shut for the new year. There's very little that's been going on in the past couple of weeks to warrant these sorts of movements. I mean, there's sort of ongoing trends and there are things to be wary of, but not to this kind of level of spookiness that we're seeing in the markets. So I'm feeling pretty gloomy about it, but I feel like if we all changed our minds, we might be all right.
Simon, you've actually been speaking to people who are not so gloomy. Fund managers looking for unloved bargains in all this stock market turmoil. Who did you speak to? What did they say? Any surprises?
Well, I think there's this thing of like, are you pessimistic about this? Are you in the sell mostly everything camp? Or are you in the cautiously optimistic camp? And I don't think that, you know, I don't really think we should be denying that there are problems out there. There is in the back of my mind the thought that I'm not so sure all the things we've done since the financial crisis are not basically just going to cause an even bigger problem somewhere down the line. But generally speaking, you know, is stuff considerably worse than it was 6 months ago? Not really. Not that much has changed. And in the medium term, if you're basically out there looking to invest and you're looking to invest in good quality companies with strong balance sheets and good growth prospects, ones that have maybe been beaten down very heavily by sentiment, then there might be some opportunities out there, because what happens when the market falls is everything gets completely sideswiped. So you can have a company that really is suffering and is probably, you know, eventually going to go to the wall. It's a rubbish company, and that gets knocked down by a load. But then you can have a good company that's going to come out the other side of it, and that also gets knocked down by a load. So we've spoken to some fund managers who are the kind of people who are out there looking for bargains. So we spoke to Alex Wright from Fidelity, James Henderson and Laura Foll of Lowland Investment Trust, and also Simon Gergel of the Merchants Trust. Now, the sort of the thread running through these is that with Alex Wright at Fidelity and with James Henderson and Laura Foll at Lowland, they've been looking at oil and gas shares and saying, well, they think it's been, you know, the sector's been beaten down too hard. Mm. And they've said that, you know, what they're looking for is the good quality companies, the companies that are going to come out the other end of this, that they think are still going to be around in 10, 20 years' time. And the name that's come up there is Shell, with both of them. Yep. But also, James Henderson at Lowland has been very bravely investing into commodity shares as well. So, and a couple of names that have come up there are Glencore and Anglo American. And the commodity sector, if you think the oil and gas sector has been hit hard, you should look at the commodity sector, you know. But these are brave investment decisions. But what James was keen to stress is that, you know, he said he's been buying in small amounts over a reasonable period of time. And he said, on the red days when you wish you weren't in the office, I'm buying some. When it really hurts, you buy a few more. This is value investing, you know. This is trying to look for bargain stocks. And it's risky, but he runs a long list of shares. So basically, you know, he invests in over 100 companies in his investment trust. Mm. And so if it gets one wrong, yeah, it doesn't matter so
much.
Is
it just for the pros? What about the amateurs among us?
There are amateurs out there looking to pick up bargain shares, but you know, you need to be doing that as part of a diversified yeah portfolio. So what I would say is, if you think that Shell is going to bounce back and you go out and buy £1,000 worth of Shell shares, then fair enough, that's your own decision. But if you've only got Shell shares in your portfolio, or you've only got Shell and you've decided to buy BP as well, or say you've only got five different stocks in your portfolio, then you're running a very big risk compared to if you've got 20 different companies in your portfolio and they all do different kinds of things. Then if you get it wrong on Shell, it's not going to matter so much.
You always say diversification and being in it for the long term. Talking about long term, short term, how long will this market turmoil last, do you reckon, Simon?
Next Tuesday. No, it's done. Yeah, yeah, all done. Next Tuesday. No, I think we're probably looking at
Easter time.
I think that basically the world is probably going to shake off this funk. I think there are some disturbing similarities with the last time we did see a big crash, the post-financial crisis era, when what you see is a lot of down days, a lot of volatility, and then intermittently a few up days. Just when you think the down days have stopped and it's going to start moving up, it moves up a bit and then it starts moving down again. But reading the markets like that is really difficult. I think that basically I genuinely think things aren't quite as bad as everyone thinks they are, and that hopefully we will see some kind of pickup. I am a bit concerned about this negative interest rates thing, though.
Well, that's one to watch. I'm sure we'll talk about that going forward. But what impact all this market turmoil having on our pensions, in particular pension freedom revolutionaries, you've been asking this week? The reforms, of course, came in last April, led to a surge in the popularity of income drawdown schemes, which let you take the sums out of your pot while the rest remains invested. But the recent troubles in financial markets has left many sitting on big losses. Now, the warnings are for you to scale back withdrawals to save your savings, as it were. All well and good if you can afford to do that. But what about those who have to access their money regardless? What are the options? Rachel, where's this warning come from?
Well, we've been looking into this a lot because there will be many people who might previously have, when they retired, put their money into an annuity, which provides a guaranteed income for life, because you no longer have to do that, and annuities have got quite unpopular, seen as not very good value for money. Increasing numbers of people are going for this drawdown option, which is something that people who generally you'd have to be pretty affluent to go for it, but it's becoming much more mainstream. So we've looked into, well, if you did opt for drawdown post pension freedoms or even prior, what kind of a situation are you going to be in? All of this kind of turmoil will have hit pensions and will have hit people's portfolios potentially quite dramatically. And the problem here is that if you have these kind of falls early on, then it has a much more detrimental effect than if you have it later. We've got a couple of really interesting graphs on our story written by a pensions and investment reporter, Tanya Jeffries, on This Is Money. There's one that shows that a portfolio starting at 100 grand, it gives three different scenarios over 6 years. If the ultimate increase in value for those three portfolios is 6%, you can still end up with very different amounts at the end, depending on how the sort of fluctuations that you see in the interim. So if you have a couple of bad years at the beginning and then things pick up, you'll end up around something like 88,000 from your 100,000 after 6 years. But if you start off with a couple of very good years at the beginning and then have a couple of rubbish years after that, you'll be up about 101,000 instead of 88. So the point is finding ways to kind of protect yourself against losses if they are early on in your drawdown plan. The best thing to do really is just don't take an income if you can at all avoid it.
And if you spend
whatever else you've got. I mean, probably not ISAs if they're in stocks and shares ISAs as well, because it's the same predicament. But if you have to, can you scale it down a bit? A lot of the time people take a set sum every month or every year rather than a percentage. So could you switch to a percentage over these more difficult months? That's another option. Another thing, I know it's all right to say it with hindsight, but one of the pensions experts we spoke to suggested that you should always have, say, a year's supply of income in some kind of, you know, pot somewhere else that you haven't put into your drawdown plan, so that you can kind of feed off that at the difficult times, and then you don't end up depreciating your drawdown at such a rapid pace.
Would do recommend reading that article from Tanya. Simon?
Well, I was just going to say that the one thing that there is also to reflect on is that essentially when you're looking at something like drawdown, you've got two elements of what you're spending. You know, hopefully you will have invested into income-producing assets. So you've got the income that's produced, say, for example, through dividends or bond coupons or whatever, and then you've got the capital that you've got invested. Now, if you're really lucky, your pension pot is so big that you can just spend the income. You don't need to worry about spending the capital. And if that's the case, then you might find that, say, for example, you're invested in funds, you might find that the dividend falls, but that and that'll eat into your income. You might find that perhaps if you're invested in investment trusts, income investment trusts, which is one of the reasons why I like those, they can hold some money over in the good years to cover the bad years, and you'll find that they're much less likely to cut their dividends. But the problem is that for most people, in all reality, they have to spend some of the capital, and so it's a process of steadily running down the pot. So if you're spending capital, like Rachel explained, at a time when the market is down, you're eating into that pot more. So that's why people need to think about this. And what's been really unfortunate is that basically pension freedom arrived almost exactly at the same point as the stock market peaked. And it's kind of been downhill ever since. And so there is this great irony that people doing the thing that everyone told them not to, which is drawing money out of their pot and putting it into cash, because they wouldn't get any growth off it, have actually ended up possibly in a slightly better position than the people who had kept it invested and done the sensible thing. But again, that's why you need to look at these things as a long-term game.
It's all about the long-term, isn't it, Simon? Well, that's the advice on money going out. What about money going into your pensions? You've been showing some brotherly love, offering your baby sister a bit of advice, haven't you, Simon? What have you been telling her?
Well, so my sister, I'd use this as an example because basically this question of how do we get people saving into a pension early is one of those ones that vexes, you know, everyone, the pensions industry, the state, us, you know. And I said, ironically, we as savers have the greatest vested interest in this. It's our wealth we're building up. Yet we also put up the most stubborn resistance to the concept. And my sister emailed me, or phoned me this week, and she's started a new job recently and she's got her work pension documents through, and she's asking me what she should do. And one of the things that she flagged was, she said, well, I just don't think I can afford that amount of money going out every month, because she's basically just had to buy a season ticket for her train, which is more than £5,000, which is an astonishing amount of money. She's moved into a new rented place with her boyfriend, you know, money's tight, and she's just like, I don't know whether I can afford to have that money coming out. And I said to her, first of all, you know, I thought I'd share this advice because I gave it to my own sister, so it's probably the best advice that I could give to someone, was basically you have to think of it as an essential part of your monthly spending, like your rent, your energy bills, or your train season ticket. And so you've got to get used to that concept. And it's best to start saving early as possible for three reasons. One, you get used to that money going out. Two, you take advantage of the free money your employer gives you and the tax relief. And three, the power of compounding, which is gains on gains, means 10 years can make a massive difference. And so this is why it really pays off to start saving into your pension in your 20s. If someone offers you a pension in your 20s, take it. Because the difference between saving for 30 years and for 40 years is effectively doubling your money. So if you do it for the extra 10 years, you double your money. And there's nowhere near double your money going in. It's just long-term gains and compounding. And also there's this other element where, as I explained it to her, she said, I've got to put this much in. I said, well, you don't actually have to put that much in. You put in X. So I've used an example here of basically someone who earned £30,000 and their employer matches their contributions up to 5%. So they pay in £125 a month. But once basic rate tax relief is added, and also their work contribution that's matching their contribution, £281.25 is paid in. So for the cost of £125 to you, £281.25 goes into your pension. Now, my sister's in the fortunate position where her work will double her contribution, so she gets even more than that. And that's one of the great reasons why you should take the money your employer offers you, take the tax relief the state will give you, and do it as early as possible, because then you could benefit from the magic of compounding.
I love the way you just said, just treat it as though it's just an everyday bill that you have to pay.
Yeah, it's an everyday bill that you have to pay, basically. That's what it is. And the great thing is that hurts to begin with, because you're like, I simply cannot afford this £100. But within about 3 months, you'll have got used to it and it'll come out of your pay before you ever even see your pay. And one day you will thank your lucky stars that you did that. And there's been a lot of comments from people saying, oh, yeah, but, you know, pension industry rip-off, government tapping into tax relief, are they going to change the rules, all these other things. And yes, I would agree with many of those things. But, you know, you can't plan for things that might not happen. All you can do is plan for the one thing you do know, which is basically if you start saving early, you will end up with more money at the end.
You have a poll on this. What do they say?
Do you wish you had saved into a pension earlier? 59% said yes, and 41% said no.
I think that says a lot about your readership.
Yeah,
though,
it says quite a lot about our readership. They basically
sensible.
They're
folk.
Basically, yeah, they're sensible folk. But also, it's not that big a jump, is it? Like, so it might be because quite a few of our readers may be older, they may be wealthier, they may have found themselves stung by the endowment scandal, by the Equitable Life scandal, and also many of them will have benefited hugely from property price growth in recent years. So there's a lot of comments from people saying, no, just put your money in property instead. Thing is, property is expensive now and it was cheap 20 years ago.
It is indeed. We'll be talking a little bit more about that later on. And also coming up, bringing up the rear, the final two of the big six energy firms join the party and cut gas prices, but by a pretty similar figure to all the others.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
So, yes, bringing up the rear, the last of the big six energy firms join the party. They cut prices this week, 5% coming off EDF Energy's standard gas tariff. That's on March the 24th, a week earlier. British Gas's will fall by 5.1%. Hurrah, you might think, for those struggling with bills. But it's brought Howes instead of too little, too late. Let's not forget that the wholesale price of gas plunged by a third last year. And aren't all the cuts just a little bit similar? Around 5% saving customers around about £30 a year. And there's another issue as well. Most of the cuts, as I mentioned earlier, come in March after the coldest months are over. Now, next month, we'll be getting the final report from a competition inquiry launched 2 years ago to look at this issue, high prices and why more of us aren't switching. Despite it getting easier, 70% of the big six customers cling on to those standard variable tariffs, forking out more than £160 more than they need to, even if they moved within the same company. Well, here's Share Radio's senior analyst, Ed Boucher.
They are very similar amounts. Of course, all of the big six would say very firmly that they're tough competitors and they're not a cartel. They're not having quiet conversations about how much they'll cut prices. And in fairness, they're probably not. But, you know, one of them sets the lead with a cut around 5% and then the other ones follow. We could see more competition in this sector, but there are smaller players and that's where the real bargains are on offer. They're not bargains, but the better value is on offer, and that's where we should be looking if we want to get the best deals.
Well, Rachel, over to you on this one. I guess it's about time EDF and British Gas cut their prices. The others have as well. Firstly, why have they all done it? And for who? Who gets this cut in prices?
Why have they done it? Cynically, because they've been told to enough times that eventually they had to. They ought to have, because wholesale prices have dropped dramatically, which is one of the biggest costs when you pay for your gas or electricity, so it stands to reason that they should pass that on to their customers. Why they didn't sooner and why the cuts weren't as big as they many people think they could have been, if you compare the size of the cuts to the fall of wholesale prices, it's rubbish.
And it's only for the standard variable tariff. What are they, if anyone's not sure?
So you can fix for a certain amount of time.
They're often the better deals, aren't they?
And they tend to be more competitive, yeah. I mean, you're gambling a little bit because you're locking in a certain price. But most of them don't have exit fees anymore anyway, so it's not really that big of an issue. Otherwise, you're on these variable ones, which more often than not go up, but it is these that are getting cheaper now rather than the fixed ones.
We can't ignore the similarity in price cuts, as Ed Boucher was just saying there. It raises the question about acting like a cartel. Indeed, we are having a competition inquiry into this.
Yeah, and we'll see what they say when eventually they get round to telling us. I think we're supposed to have in the next couple of weeks, but it's been delayed again, the final results of the Competition and Markets Authority probe into the energy market. Not supposed to use the cartel word. And I suppose that their justification would be that ultimately their costs are fairly similar.
No one's suggesting they're talking amongst each other, but it does look as though it's very similar, doesn't it?
It does, but if things were working well, then you would imagine that one of them would come along and cut prices by, say, 10%, because they can, and the smaller suppliers are doing it, because that would show signs of competition. If you want to nick customers of each other, cut your prices, but none of them are bothering. And still, it's one of those incredible things that switching numbers are still so low. It's not that they're cutting prices in response to customers who are moving around. They are a little bit, but it's still numbers are low. But it's you've had Ofgem, you've had Amber Rudd, the energy secretary, you've had consumer groups, you've had us, everyone saying, what are you doing? Why aren't you passing on cuts to your customers? And eventually they've had to give in and do it.
We can criticise them all we like, though, but is that the onus on us as well to switch around? You can save around £300 by switching. The challenger firms are in abundance at the moment, unprecedented number of suppliers. I think we're talking here about 30. Market share gone up for the challengers from, I think it was 2% in 2012 to over 10% now, but we're still not moving.
Yeah, I don't understand it, because it's quite easy. And you can save, if you haven't saved before, it's about £300, £400. And one of the things that the Competition and Markets Authority is looking into is who are these people who have never switched? And they tend to be older customers. They tend to be people who have never switched at all. So were with British Gas before privatisation and just haven't moved around. It'll be more sort of vulnerable households. And so you find yourself in a situation where those who are least able to pay are probably subsidising those who do choose to move around.
But actually, you don't actually have to move company. You can stay within your supplier, as I said there, and you can save yourself £160. Should companies do more to alert their customers to the lower fixed rate tariffs that they've got?
Well, they do send letters because they've been told to by Ofgem, and they've also been told what those letters have to look like, so they have to be pretty simple. These price comparison websites are everywhere. They spend something like £25 million on advertising last year. A lot of money goes into telling people about the benefits of shopping around and switching. DEC, the government, has also been had campaigns encouraging people to switch. Not sure what else to say.
Well, the only thing that I would say is go to thisismoney.co.uk/fuelbills. There you will find a tool powered by Energy Helpline, who we have carefully chosen as our energy bills partner because they basically offer a clean look at the real best deals on the market, and there's no fudging the tables as some comparison sites have been accused of. Put your postcode in, put how much you spend on your gas and electricity each month in, and it will tell you who is the cheapest supplier, and it will tell you how much money you can save. And all you have to do is spend a couple of minutes filling in a form and pushing a button, and you might save yourself £300, and that is definitely worth it in anyone's book.
Definitely. Still to come, ageism and mortgages, and how much should we really spend on an engagement ring? But this week, the Home Secretary set up a new task force consisting of police, banks and government officials to combat fraud across the UK. Taking a look at online banking fraud alone, well, according to the latest figures, that went up just shy of 50% in 2014, latest figures we've got, compared with 2013, totalling £479 million. The third year in a row it's gone up. Now we're being warned to stay extra vigilant after a new wave of so-called smishing attacks, which has seen thieves drain thousands of pounds from current accounts. In one case, a Santander customer lost all of their life savings. Firstly, online and bank fraud, just how much are you seeing it rise? Anecdotally speaking, Simon, what are readers telling you? How many stories do you find you're now reporting on?
Well, I don't know whether we're fine with reporting on more stories about it. I think we probably are reporting on more stories, but I don't know whether it's been a doubling or a trebling or a quadrupling. What I would say is concerning is that basically a lot of the stories that we are reporting on now basically involve the weakest link, and the weakest link is you. So bank security has dramatically improved over recent years. You know, everything from chip and PIN to the annoying little card readers that you have to use to get into your internet banking to shuttling backwards and forwards between your mobile phone and the internet with special codes. But that genuinely has made it quite a lot harder to hack into your banking. But fraudsters are now targeting that weakest link, and that weakest link is you. And the way that they target you is by trying to convince you to do something, i.e., hand over all your money. that is the really unfortunate position that some people find themselves in. And what makes it doubly unfortunate is if you have basically authorised the transfer, you have handed over the money, you've been caught out by someone telling you to put it into a safe account or something like that, your bank is under no obligation to give you that money back, and they will find it very, very difficult to track down. And that's what this smishing scam is, basically.
Well, that's what we're hearing as well in this one case of the Santander customer. Firstly, what is smishing and what has happened in this particular case, Rachel?
So smishing is the latest scam whereby somehow a scammer will send a text message to you that looks like it's coming from your bank. So if your bank has sent you text messages in the past, they'll end up in a chain of texts on your phone. Somehow they have the software to be able to put their text message in that stream, so you think it's coming from them. And it might have a message on it saying something nearly identical to that your bank would tell you legitimately. Yeah. You know, we have reason to believe that you've been a victim of fraud, please phone us. And the number that they give you is a number of a scammer. And then often they'll have a certain amount of your personal information already. That happened in this case that we've reported about. And so you trust them because, well, they you know your account number and they might know your address or whatever it is. And for a scammer, you have to build up a bit of a jigsaw puzzle of different bits of personal information in order to be able to access someone's account or their funds, or to be able to convince a bank that you are that they are you. And that's very easy to do when you have a certain amount of information already. And this person,
Edward Smith from Sheffield,
Edward Smith lost his life savings. And as Simon said, he did authorise the transaction. I think often what happens is, one, that they're very convincing, these scammers, and what they do is so similar to that a bank would do anyway, that you believe them. And two, you get in quite, I don't know if Edward Smith did, but I imagine, and it sort of happened to me as well, actually, you get in quite a fluster when your bank phones you up and says, we're really worried that someone's draining your account. You get worried. You don't necessarily think through, who is this person? How did they have this information?
Well, interestingly, when he got the legitimate call from Santander, they actually called him by the wrong name as Edward Ball, not Edward Smith. So, of course, he thought the genuine one was not genuine at all. It's a terrible case reading this through. But what's interesting as well, or what struck me particularly, is this particularly pertinent now because more people are holding savings in their current accounts?
This is our fear, because current accounts often offer, at the moment, a higher rate of interest than you get in a savings account, then people are more likely to keep their money in current accounts. Savings accounts, if you suddenly see lots of transactions or bigger transactions than usual, you might question it. But current accounts, there's likely to be sort of more fluctuations, and it might be harder to trace those sorts of things. A bank might not necessarily pick up on it in the same way.
Well, now let's turn our attention to something a little bit different. Well off, hard working, never late paying bills. The perfect borrowers for a mortgage, right? Not so, according to lenders. Why? Age. Now, you focused on pensioners Eric and Muriel Fisher, who took out an interest-only mortgage back in 2005 to help their children, as many want to do at the moment, get on the housing ladder. But now they've been told to repay that loan next year when Mr. Fisher turns 75. But this is increasingly affecting older borrowers, isn't it? Here's Paul Broadhead, who's head of mortgage policy at BSA.
We've got an ageing population generally, and people now having to, either wanting to or needing to access housing wealth in ways that they haven't really needed to before. And that partly is care funding, because we've had this asset-based welfare approach that governments have gradually introduced over the last 15 years or so, meaning that people need to pay for their own long-term care. They've got assets above a certain amount before the state will step in and support them. Because of rising house prices as well, we're seeing increasing numbers of people having to access equity in their home to help their children or grandchildren get onto the housing ladder. We've also got people, because we've now seen the almost the end of the defined benefit pension schemes, where people know exactly what they're going to get in retirement. We're seeing people need to access equity to actually supplement their pension income into retirement. So all of this change has happened pretty rapidly. And what we've seen is the mortgage market as a whole hasn't reacted at the same pace. It has started to react, but I think more needs to be done.
So, Simon, I mean, as a result of these tougher new rules, lenders have imposed lower maximum age limits on mortgage lending. Are they allowed to discriminate on the basis of age?
Well, in theory, you shouldn't discriminate on the basis of age. But in practice, obviously, they are, because they, and what they, the way that they do it is by giving what they say are very good reasons. Now, what's interesting about, you know, the tougher new mortgage rules is that a lot of stuff gets blamed on the tougher new mortgage rules and the mortgage market review.
It came in April 2014.
And now, as I recall it, and I don't have the document in front of me to trawl through, there is nothing in there that says that you can't lend to people above a certain age. And a lot of these cases are completely farcical. So you have people with final salary pensions, guaranteed income, that cannot be taken away from them, basically. You know, the only way they're going to lose that income is if their pension scheme, once they've started taking that pension, is if their pension scheme goes bust. And if their pension scheme goes bust, they're actually protected up to a certain, you know, level, or maybe actually be protected for their entire pension. Their income is much more secure than someone who's a worker in their 30s, for example, who could lose their job. But they're finding that they're being denied these mortgages. And often these mortgages are for tiny amounts compared to the value of the property. I mean, in this instance, you know, it's a £92,000 mortgage against a £650,000 property. And he's got a defined benefit pension. And the monthly payment is £310 a month. And they've made it perfectly clear that that is not an issue for them in terms of that payment going out. Yet they're being turned down for this mortgage. And this is not an isolated case. This is happening to people all over the show. One of the problems is to do with the fact that there are more people now with interest-only mortgages that they haven't cleared at the end of the term. Perhaps they had a Duff endowment policy that didn't pay off, or perhaps they were just involved in that whole thing in the 2000s where there was a massive lending boom and banks and building societies stopped checking that people had any plan in place to repay the interest-only mortgage. And now they're being denied mortgages. And we've got another lady in here, basically, in this story. Her name is Susan Bailey. And basically, she had planned to sell her home and move abroad. But actually, she's now, it'd be impossible to do this, basically, which is what Santander would prefer she does, because she cares for her 91-year-old mother. And she doesn't want to leave. She doesn't want to leave her. She said, "I won't abandon her. She is a loving, very sweet person, and I don't want the upheaval of a move just yet because I have a lot of responsibility." She's got £150,000 interest-only mortgage. She turned 70 last month, and basically she's being told that she can't extend the term. And realistically, if someone can afford to keep meeting those payments, which in the modern low-interest rate world are often really quite low, then I think the banks should be giving them a lot more leeway.
Sounds like a computer says no kind of situation. But older people, we're hearing, just today in England, are living longer than ever before, Rachel. New figures showing that men who reach 65 can now expect to live another 19 years. Women a further 21 years. We're expecting this issue to keep going. People are also getting on the property ladder later in life. They're going to have to sort this out, aren't they?
Yeah, it makes no sense for borrowers, but lenders, it doesn't make sense for them either. I mean, if you've got a guaranteed, as Simon says, you've got a guaranteed income, you've got borrowers who are not going to default, why would you not lend to them? And particularly, if you can't get onto the property ladder until much later in life, and then you want to take out, as people are, 30-year, 35-year mortgages, which is the only way that many people are managing to buy a home in with prices as they are, it's just not sustainable to say that, no, that's it, your time's up at whatever it is, 65 or 70, particularly because people are working for much longer and will continue to do so. It does need a complete rethink. And, I mean, the regulator has these very sort of blunt tools that they enforced last year. But then also there's the advice is if you've been hit by this, go to the ombudsman. There is recourse. And certainly it doesn't seem like the regulator is the one who's saying that this is what has to happen.
Finally, what price? Love. Love it all over. Valentine's Day almost upon us. Retailers, well, they certainly love it, especially the jewellers. Proposals unsurprisingly go up around about this time of year. And with it, that age-old dilemma for anyone about to pop the question, just how much should you be spending on that ring? Well, it depends on who you listen to. Some say you should part with 1 month's salary, others three. But don't believe the hype, though. The average spend works out at £573. Well, we went out and asked you what you thought.
Shut 'em up, me darling. I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime.
£400. Traditional one's three times your monthly salary, I believe, which, yeah, sounds about right.
I am too old for that.
£400?
I don't think the actual financial cost of a ring necessarily signifies it at all.
Sometimes you can find very pretty old ones, for example. I think you shouldn't bankrupt yourself about it. Have something that gives you pleasure.
Roughly, I've 5,000.
I'm trying to remember when we got engaged, mid-70s, which is a long time ago, and earning very little. In fact, my wife came with me to choose the ring, which I think is not what one's meant to do, but we did it. And I've absolutely no idea how much it cost. Now, of course, it'd be quite different, but, you know, she's the first and so far only wife, so, you know, if there's another time, then we'll think again.
Almost so romantic there. So far, the only wife. £573, Simon, this seems quite low. What should you be spending?
It does seem quite low, doesn't it? When you Google how much should I spend on an engagement ring and you have results bringing up a month's salary, or a survey in autumn 2014 by Brides magazine that the average UK spend on an engagement ring is just under £2,500.
I wonder what Grooms magazine would say to that.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a whole industry around this, isn't there, encouraging people to spend more.
So what advice do you have for anyone shopping for a ring?
What advice do I have for anyone shopping for a ring is I would go to Hatton Garden, London's jewellery centre. I don't know about jewellery centres in other cities around the UK, but maybe it's even worth jumping on a train and coming to Hatton Garden. And if you go to Hatton Garden, basically it's a street and a couple of streets off it, and it is packed full of jewellers. And they are there selling rings and other things, but they sell a lot of rings, they sell a lot of diamonds, and you can go from shop to shop. And you can negotiate. The price that you're quoted is very rarely the actual final price. And they will design a ring, you know, to how you want it to look. And you can choose the diamond, and you can get a certificated diamond, which basically tells you about the clarity and the cut. And basically, you'll end up saving a lot of money compared to just going into a high street jeweller.
You still couldn't remember that third C, could you, Simon, after an hour of the show?
I can't.
And on that Hatton Garden, I went to a wedding and said to someone, is that a Tiffany's ring? And she said, no, it's from Hatton Garden. I'm not sure I'm that much of an expert in checking out where rings are from, but I still thought that was pretty good. Editor Simon Lambert, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you so much for joining us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years. Share Radio.